afternoon, everyone. I think we'll get started now. My name is Jeremy Clark. I am one of the regional directors of the McGill Alumni Association. I'm based in Calgary, Alberta. It's always nice to be back for homecoming and I guess now Parents Weekend. So I'm sure we have parents, we have alumni, maybe we have some current students here. And it's nice to see all of you. And I know you'll get a lot out of the presentation today. I also am on the board of the Faculty of Science, so it's kind of interesting today. We have a lawyer speaking about genetics, and I love the interplay of two different disciplines here. During my time here, I did study genetics. I now own a financial services company, so I have kind of a varied background myself, so I do appreciate kind of the multidisciplinary approach. When we think of our time at McGill, a number of things come immediately to mind. The friends we made, the activities we participated in, the classes that we took, I'm sure some fun that everyone had, how could you not, in Montreal. However, if there's one thing I think that we all carry as we go forward at any stage in our life, it's an intellectual curiosity, and I think that's what brought us all to this great school in the first place. During homecoming, McGill welcomes alumni, some of whom are responsible for several groundbreaking ideas through its gates. But it also welcomes current students, who in a few years will leave their own scholarly mark on society and their parents into the university family. In fact, Parents Weekend, and only I think it's fifth year, is really almost on par now with the homecoming experience. So there's plenty of activities for parents. I think sometimes much to the chagrin of current students sometimes. But everyone is welcome here, and thank you for coming. And this weekend's visitors have no doubt noticed there's some significant changes, even compared to last year on campus. You probably noticed on the way up here that McTavish Street is now a pedestrian mall. Shockingly enough, they actually have opened up one side of McLennan Library, which is now a beautiful service point, and the cyber tech, which is very, very interesting the way they've opened up that building. These green initiatives underline the university's commitment to sustainability, and certainly they do reflect the forward-thinking nature of this institution. Classes Without Quizzes, or one of the best acronyms in the world, QUOCS, what they're called, have really become one of the most popular homecoming events. These are extremely well attended every year, diverse range of topics. We certainly enjoy hosting them, and we're very pleased you can join us for this lecture series. This is the second out of four sessions today, and you certainly get to hear McGill's most interesting academics speak about a number of topics. You're welcome to take notes if you like. You don't have to. I'm told there'll be no quiz at the end. So far they've kept their promise at all these, so there'll be no quiz. And really all that you're asked to do is listen with an open mind, enjoy. There'll be some time for questions after the presentation. So I'm sure we can get a good discussion going. So today's topic is entitled Promises, Promises, Human Genetics, and You. And this is Professor Bartha Maria Knoppers over here. And the subject is certainly a timely one. Medical science is increasingly abuzz with talk of mapping our DNA in an effort to predict which diseases are most likely to threaten us in the future. The advent of genome research may ultimately give rise to a new brand of personalized medicine, one that might be able to address our health risks before they encroach on our lives. Trained as a lawyer, last year Professor Knoppers was appointed director of the Center of Genomics and Policy at McGill University and Genome Quebec Innovation Center. She is an expert on the ethical aspects of genetics, genomics, and biotechnology, and her work raises important questions about these controversial topics. Please join me in welcoming her today.
Thank you. Bonjour. Welcome back to Montreal, those of you who came from other places in Canada. I am a former McGill grad myself and only came back after 25 years of teaching on the other side of the mountain, so came back to McGill in 2009. I'm very pleased to be back, but I had to get a map to remind myself of where everything was, so I guess it's the same for you. I received in the mail, even though I'm a law professor, I tend to read probably more science than I read law cases now. I received a report called the Hastings Center Report. It's probably one of the most well-known bioethics centers in the United States. And by chance, because it was only Thursday this week that I received it, it was on personalized medicine. Will it work? Where will it take us? And I thought, not too much homework to do for Saturday. What was interesting was that the controversy has actually arisen mainly in the one country that is probably the most market-driven, and that is the United States. And this summer, on July 22nd, the U.S. Government Accountability Office released a study in which it sent identical DNA samples to four private genetic testing firms to test for 15 common diseases and conditions. These are these direct-to-consumer companies where you can you'll see the advertisements in Time magazine or any People magazine or any kind of popular magazine, where for $399.99 you can actually receive in the mail a package which has a vial that you can spit into and then send it back. All the mail, postage, everything is covered under the $399.99 and receive back your so-called genetic profile. What happened when they sent it to these 15 common, when they tested for these 15 common conditions, that all the results were contradictory. For example, various companies told a 48-year-old male that he had average, below average, or above average risk for prostate cancer between the different companies. These contradictions can be explained, said the companies, because we use different genetic markers, and so scientists disagree about what these markers mean. Well, so much for your money. Then they said, and the GAA, the Government Accountability Office, well, the risk predictions that they did receive often contradicted even with the actual illnesses that the donors had. For instance, one company said a donor had a below average risk of atrial fibrillation, when in fact he had had a pacemaker installed 13 years earlier. And in a separate study by the same office of the marketing practices of these companies, two of the 15 companies used information from the consumer's profiles, where you fill in what you eat, what you live, what your parents, what you think your parents had, your aunts and uncles, and so on. They use these consumer profiles to recommend that they buy expensive nutritional supplements which their ordinary diet could not meet. So that's one commentary, if you like, done by the Office of Accountability of the U.S. government. However, at the same time, one driving force behind these new direct-to-consumer tests and this private industry of genetic tests is that in last year alone, in the U.S., over 300 billion prescription medications, $300 billion worth of prescription medications were wasted. Why were they wasted? Well, because the drugs don't work in many people, kill people, the dosage is incorrect, or they have severe side effects, including death, hospitalizations, and so on. So on the one hand, you have this more personalized saying, we can make drugs to order, drugs that won't kill. For every asthma person, there may be a different asthma drug. And on the other hand, they're saying that this genetic profiling, individualized as it is, will actually allow you to determine your future, change your lifestyle, decide if you're going to have children or not. So is this true? And I don't know. I come to science, I guess, like the public does, with an open mind and a lot of curiosity. And are there any physicians here in the audience? Two, three. Good, because I have a broken foot in case I collapse. It's bone number 223, by the way. How many, any geneticists in the audience? No? Lawyers? Any legal people? Okay. All right. So let's just then to go a little bit down the genetics route to start with, and then switch over to examine the impact of actual real validated developments in genetics with what this new, sometimes called a democratization of knowledge, giving people direct access, that finally consumers can take their health care into their hands and not be dependent either on physicians or geneticists. So I'll start with where everything started, which is, of course, with the real personalized medicine that physicians have been practicing for a long time, and that is the person-to-person contact that comes from the relationship between physicians and their patients, and all the ethical principles, all the way starting from the Hippocratic Oath that accompany that relationship. Respect for the person, privacy, and so on, confidentiality of data, and bench to bedside, if you like, continuum. And with all of this, of course, physicians are accredited, they have exams, they have to do refresher courses like we lawyers had to do this year. We were really left out of that for quite a while. And in that sense, they constitute a profession that is accountable and is also accredited and has a degree of oversight and the disciplinary actions that come with it. So that's a traditional physician-patient relationship that we're used to, and even though it has lessened to some extent with a lack of family availability of family practitioners in this province. And genetics, and this is where my genetics formal education stopped. As you will remember, grade 8 biology began, of course, with Mendel's peas and the idea of hereditability and the notion of genes and single genes accounting for certain effects. And Mendelian medicine is still what characterizes genetics today. No matter what you'll see on the slides, what we'll conclude on personal genomics or not, largely the practice of genetics is still focused on these 6,000 or so rare disorders that often run in families, sometimes run in ethnic subpopulations, and that are transmitted through the generations. And accompanying this Mendelian model are the same ethics, the medical ethics that accompany medical practice generally. So it's no different till very recently, as we will see, in terms of what the ethics part of the practice of genetic medicine as distinguished from the ethics of other forms of medicine. Now, some people will say it is different because it's familial and it's got historical consequences with the abuses of World War II, and it's hereditary, so you transmit it to someone. And it's true. It has these aspects, but then other conditions have those as well. But the genetics that everyone knows, particularly my students, is that of CSI and Gattaca. And here we have your clothes are in the other room, telling my partner all we need to know about you. All you need is a single hair. And inevitably, I usually start my classes with the latest CSI episode, even though it has nothing to do really with medical genetics. It's forensics, right? It's identification based on using DNA to situate what they think was that person at that place at that time, a bit like the O.J. Simpson case. So in the mind of students, if you talk genetics, it's either Gattaca, CSI, or it's one of those soap operas, As the World Turns, with surrogates, clones, artificial assisted procreation, sale of organs, and so on. So that's the world that people think about. And this is important because policy and policymakers often are more affected by the perceptions, public perceptions of genetics, than they are about the reality of what the science is or isn't. So when you're thinking about policy in this area, they think it's deterministic. You are your gene. Your code is unfolding as it should. And it's predictive. If you say you're going to get it, you're going to get it. So they still have the dominant recessive sort of gene model. Now, all of this changed in 2001. I think this is the Time magazine from, can't read the date. At the 2001, even though the whole gene wasn't really mapped till 2003, an announcement at the White House. And there was Tony Blair on one side and Clinton on the other. And, yes. Is that possible? the pictures at Clinton in any event. And there was Francis Collins from the NIH, from the public initiative to map the whole human genome, the sequences, just the sequences of the human genome. And there was Craig Venter on the other side. Craig Venter is an entrepreneur who had a private company called Celera that was in the race. That was what it was called. It was also being called the Gene Wars, to be the first to map the human genome. And the public sector, the Francis Collins sector and many others, had adopted a policy, what they called open access. They borrowed that from the IT world a bit, where they would, every 48 hours, the Germans, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Americans, the Canadians that were involved in this map, this SNP consortium, single nucleotide polymorphisms, the SNP consortium, the public SNP consortium, they would make them public every 48 hours. Celera would allow scientists to have access to its mapping effort if they signed over their IP, and they kept everything private. In addition, they took everything that was in the public sector and used it as well. And I don't know how they did it, but somehow there must have been some political machinations, because they actually announced the map together on the same day. But what's unique about this map, which is only like it's not even as good as the Google Maps we have today. It's not geospatial. It's really pointing out to where the gene sequences are located, their addresses, but without knowing who lives there or what it means. So it's a pretty basic map. And yet, it was the first time in history that pharma, the big pharma, which usually castigated and as being the bad, capitalist companies, actually were part of the SNP consortium. Because pharma, Pfizer, Glaxo, etc., realized that they needed this information as much as the fundamental scientists in the universities or anywhere else. So they decided to classify this fundamental information as pre-competitive, preemptive information, and put their money into the SNP consortium as well. So this was the first time that we've had this private-public in the SNP consortium working together. And it's interesting, because we'll see later on that the model is coming back. But that map wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to know that we only had about 6,000, 28,000 genes. We thought humans would have 100,000, and actually, I think, is it the worm or the yeast or the potato? We're somewhere in there with other living forms. A very humbling discovery that we weren't really that unique in terms of just gene sequences. And so they decided to build another project, Francis Collins again involved in this one, called the HapMap, the haplotype map. And this is a map that would bunch SNP single nucleotide morphisms together by ancestry. So this map went and took four groups, Chinese from Beijing, Japanese from Kyoto, the Yoruba in Abidjan, Nigeria, and some Caucasians in Utah, using the CEPH, won't go into all the details, and by ancestry regrouped them into these big blocks. So this was interesting, because this time they put everything up on the internet. So they had to create consent forms in five different languages. Yeah, it was a four different languages, where people would consent not just to be in the public domain, but really in the internet. But to avoid any possibility of re-identification, a la CSI, they actually scrambled some of the results. They took more samples than they needed, and so on, and they sent them all to a biorepository in the USA, where anyone in the world can actually have access to it for research. And what's interesting is that these volunteers had very different ideas about their participation in this map. Some required a lot of, community consultation. The Chinese were really proud. They said, forget this informed consent stuff. We're finally, on the map. We've made it as a recognized country, and so on and so on. And in Nigeria, they had serious discussions with the chief of the community, and it became very much a model for diversity in informed consent procedures. So this is now also available and has been followed by a project called the 1,000 Genomes Project. So they're going beyond the four to the 1,000. And finally, what characterizes this sort of last decade, if you like, of genetic research and so on, is that even in the disease areas, so leaving the SNP people and your fundamental scientists, your proteomics, genomics, bioinformatics people aside, even in the disease research community, in the last decade has seen, particularly the last 5 years, the major disease communities come up with international consortia. So it's not my collection, my samples, my families, my fridge, my patents, and my publications, but these international consortia, diabetes, cancer, malaria gen, the big one in Africa and so on, and characterizing then a different way of doing research. So what does this mean? This means that individuals who participate, the public who actually gives their blood, their urine, answers questionnaires about this thick, come in, provide the materials with no expectations of any information coming back to them or any results or knowing if maybe one day there's going to be a drug available specific to them. So we have a form of research that's very different from the clinical trials we know. You know, the ones you see in the newspaper. If you've, my students often go when they need money and so on. It says some 8 hours of tests in a lab on the weekend at Anna Farm or one of these companies here in Montreal. Contract research organizations, they're called. And then you can get paid and you're tested and they give you drugs and you try a drug and you get another blood test and et cetera. Nothing like that at all. This is really a population biobanking, they call it, where you're simply donating for unspecified future research. Has anyone here participated in a population biobanking in Canada? Cartagene, Ontario Health Services. Which one were you in? You were in Cartagene. Anyone else participated? Do you have any comments on the process or
I'll reserve comments.
For questions period? Okay. So there is Cartagene, and Cartagene is one of five cohorts in Canada. The Ontario Health study, you saw it yesterday in the Globe and Mail, 150,000. The Alberta, the Generation study in British Columbia, and the Atlantic Path are all rolling out, if you like, in creating a different kind of resource for research, not for any one disease, but more to allow the disease people to have better information. And it's my firm belief, and I'll give you my conclusion now, that I think that these population reference biobanks will actually be what is needed for if we ever will get personalized medicine, to validate, to compare, to replicate, and so on. But what's interesting is that we have citizens now also participating in solidarity with these studies. So what does this mean then, genetics then, for families, for persons, for citizens, if we come back to Mendel and so on? Well, I can tell you that the whole deontological framework surrounding geneticists and practicing geneticists is going to change. I didn't think it would because I thought that genetic information would eventually be treated as normal, sensitive medical information. A bit like cancer, nobody talked about in the 50s. Psychiatric disorders, no one talked about it until about 30 years ago. We'd get used to genetics. We'd exchange profiles over coffee. I'm at risk for this. Oh, but I'm at risk for that. Oh, I heard my cousin has the same risk as you. Don't worry, nothing happened to him, and so on. But that hasn't come about. And one of the reasons it hasn't come about is that there are new duties that are emerging. When you know something about yourself, or when a physician or a geneticist knows something about you, it means something for someone else by virtue of its being genetic. People say, well, this is classical. It is. And genes run in families, and you know what you have in your family or don't have in your family. But now that we're moving to common conditions, not the rare genetic single gene disorders, you might have a very high risk of something that's cancer, diabetes, hypertension, or whatever. Is that sufficient for you to have a duty to warn your sister of the breast cancer gene, for instance? Or to tell your children if you have the colon cancer gene and it happens to be one that it could be operated at the age of adolescence and that child would not be at risk in adulthood. And I say this because I was involved in a case. I try to avoid the courts as much as possible. But I was called as an expert witness here. It's in the public record, so I can talk about it. About a situation here in Montreal in the 1970s with a very rare condition where a researcher and a physician thought that maybe the child, very severely disabled, might have a such condition. Weren't sure, but did extra additional tests and so on, and finally thought that it might be, and wrote a small paper, "We think it might be this." And 30 years later, 72, maybe even more, the physician, now retired, was sued. Why? Because in informing the husband and wife that such and such tests were going to be done to see if perhaps it was this disorder, when it was finally confirmed that it probably was, at this time the wife no longer came in and was upset and so on, and told the husband and thought that was the end of it. But in the meantime, after following a divorce, et cetera, moving away, coming back, then not telling the nieces, not telling the cousins, not telling the uncles, the niece from the sister of the woman 30 years later had another child with the same condition. And beside that woman did have a second child with the same, but never told anyone. Now, how is a physician in 1972 supposed to know that and prepare and communicate with the family for something that might happen 30 years later? So you can see why, from a medical ethical point of view, and certainly from a legal point of view, this is quite a stunning result. So is there now a duty to warn from physicians? Is there a duty to warn between family members? Do we have to reconstruct families now and sort of follow genealogies? So what then is the future of medicine, and what does it mean, this personalized medicine? Will it change anything? Well, the Times Best Invention of 2008 called this, and there's your little package with your spit vial and everything in the little top, called it one of the inventions of 2008. And actually one of the companies, the best known company, 23andMe, is run by the wife of Google, right? And the owner of Google himself, Google has, as you know, the highest information system, interesting marriage here in every sense of the word, has a Sergey Brin. He and him himself has taken the test and found he's at 50% increased risk for Parkinson. And Linda Avey, the wife who was interviewed for this interview here, actually then discovered while she was pregnant, because of the husband's test, that the child she was carrying would have a 50% increased risk of Parkinson. So, as though that isn't enough, there's about three or four companies here in Canada and about 20 or so in the States. A month ago, till the FDA shut them down, Walgreens was going to put on their shelves in Walgreens in the United States the Insight, I-N-S-I-G-H-T, saliva collection kit at Walgreens for $20 to $30 in all stores across the United States. People could pick it up and then send their saliva sample to Pathway, the name of the company. And they said, for this money, you can, one, have individualized genetic report for drug response, $79 more. Pre-pregnancy planning, I've quite figured that one out, $179. And health conditions, $179, general health. Or a combo if you buy all three for $249. And the FDA closed down this public sale the next day. It is, however, popular and kind of chic, and I don't know if Homecoming is doing it this year, to offer. As you know, there used to be these 30-second kind of date things, and then now they have what they call spitting parties, where you can sit and actually do this and send it in together as a couple. And this is, reminds me of Gattaca, remember, with the hair when they went to the counter to test. So is it really a new way, if you like, of putting life in your hands? Is it an empowerment thing to say, okay, we have physicians, when we need them, we'll go see them, or we have lawyers, we'll continue with them. But I just want to know, and why should anyone stop me from knowing? And if I want to waste my money as a consumer, why shouldn't I be allowed to do so? And for all kinds of reasons. Now, there are companies that say they can tell you before you spend money on your children if they have musical talent or you should put them into sports, or they're artistic or they're not artistic, and so on and so on. And what they call recreational genetics. So this has become a worldwide industry. And particularly, apparently, those recreational aspects more in Asian countries where the parents put a very high value on their children's education and highly competitive Asian cultures, as I was told in Singapore recently. But you can ask yourself, when you do that, you know, you are finding things out, presumably probabilistic things, not definitive things, about yourself, but also about your children. And there's absolutely no guarantee of any quality or safety. Bring it on. People generally choose to get unpleasant things over with quickly. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's just curiosity driven. So if you want to spend $400, and prices will probably go down, why shouldn't you be empowered and free to do so? And not only is there no oversight, which is why FDA has asked all these companies to sort of stop for the time being, unless they can show that their tests can be validated in another lab, or that they have the quality and safety that they say they have, or, more recently, that there be some medical person on their staff or a genetic counselor. Because what if people call in and say, oh my God, I have my APOE, I think that's an Alzheimer, isn't it? That's what my mother had, that means I'm going to get it, and so on, and they might make life-changing decisions based on this non-interpreted, non-interpretable information. So the question is, and in addition to our health card, our Quebec health card, will we one day be having this kind of a card that we can use and put in every time we get to the emergency room? Before they make any mistakes, they can right away get the readout on what we, not only what we're allergic to, but what drug works and what drug doesn't work. And I recently, because I travel a lot and get stuck at Dorval, as I still call it, had one of these Nexus cards, you know, the biometrics. I mean, that's as individualizing probably. And I mean, it's a fourth degree security check, and I'll do anything not to stand in line at customs. And so why not? If I make that choice, why not the same for the personal DNA? And it's gotten to the point where some of my colleagues are now in with George Church in a project called the Personal Genome Project. And he considers it, and all the colleagues, to be the opening up of medicine in a democratic, accessible way, provided the costs keep coming down. And he has a project called the Personal Genome Project, where if you go in, you put your genome in the public domain. You are actually online for anyone to access. And James Watson has done this, one of the two discoverers of the Crick Watson, you know, the double helix. Francis Collins has done it, got contradictory results from two companies. And there are many other. Desmond Tutu has put his genome in this Personal Genome Project. So this will happen then, is that people say, okay, now you've got all this knowledge. People are putting it up in the either through testing, getting their own information so nobody else can see it, including insurers, or they're going into these public projects, such as the Personal Genome Project. And then they want to know, what are you doing with this information and what do you have to offer? And they'll come back after they get their printout. Here, they'll come back here in Canada, and they'll go to their physician and say, what does this mean? And which physician can interpret, you know, this kind of information that probably was not even taught till about 2 or 3 years ago in our medical schools? And what impact will that have on our healthcare system? They pay $399.99, but then the cost on the system of the effects of them being what's called the worried well. But George Church is eternally optimistic. He's a wonderful scholar, really idiosyncratic scientist. But anyway, he's definitely thinks that, well, doctors will customize a program know about your genes, your microbiome, your bacteria, your allergies, fungi, viruses, and your immune system. And just like remote villages now have, you know, phones and internet and so on, we can also assemble healthcare solutions appropriate to customs, to geography, to diet, to lifestyle, to individuals, and so on. And studying the specific combinations of genes and environment, which is what Cartagena is doing here in Quebec, can lead to changes in diet, drugs, and behavior, and we'll all be healthier. It's not that this project, like any other project, is trying to make people immortal. It's just trying to help them die healthy. I know it sounds like a non sequitur, but it makes sense to me. Anyway, in the near future, to continue with George Church, a complex ecosystem of healthcare and software providers will empower doctors to treat each participant as a unique individual. Your genome will be sequenced every year. They think they're going to have it down to $100 in about 5 years. We'll check for the emergence of cancer cells, autoimmune cells, inflammation, and so on, and predict what treatment may work best, not just knowing, but shaping your biology. So in a way, you'll probably be responsible because you have this knowledge. It'll be your fault if you haven't changed your lifestyle, your diet, your exercise, and so on, because now you can be mapped and people can tell you what you need to do. So I don't know if you remember the Western movies of the, maybe prior to Clint Eastwood, what would it be? The movies where they had snake oil people, you know, would come around and it was just usually flour and water and some oil mixed to whatever. So is this the new snake oil, or is there any potential for this new science of individualizing genetics down to probabilistic risk on an individual basis? And I think there is one, and I think it's going to come in the drugs. And there's a good part to this and a bad part. The good part is the $300 billion mistakes, deaths, over prescriptions, wrong prescriptions that I read to you at the beginning. And we have drugs tailored already in the breast cancer area, as you know. Herceptin is one, the specific biomarker. So there are drugs now already coming out that women with breast cancer should only take this drug and not go through the usual route, because probably any other route would be toxic. So it's tailored to the genes. To get there, of course, we need to, as I mentioned at the beginning, take these population maps that we're building now of citizens presumably healthy who don't come in because they're sick, but they're statistically selected to represent a population. Make this map that is a valid sort of reference map, if you like, genome variation map, against which we can put and test different diseases and so be able to make these promises real. The biggest challenge, however, is probably not scientific. The biggest challenge is that we're going to have to change our medical system. How many people got the H1N1 vaccine last fall before Christmas? A good number. Of all that number, how many of you thought or still think that you needed it? Yeah, smaller number. What happens then is when you have public health situations or population health situations that, because our principle, and we certainly believe it, of equity in the Canadian accessibility and so on, and Canadian health system is so strong, we want to keep it that way, and universality and so on, is that everyone gets it because we don't have the knowledge that allows us to stratify, to say these people are the super susceptible, these people are the super transmitters like we had with SARS, these people are the super resistors. Let's not give them the pill or the test or the whatever, or isolate them or quarantine them like SARS and so on. To do that, we have to get used to being cut up, if you like, into communities of risk. And you might not be at risk for one thing, but you may be at risk in another community for something else, or subpopulation, or by ethnicity, or by race, or by age, or by gender. And that's where politicians get stuck. Because unless we use these big population maps to stratify and create subpopulations and so on for public health purposes, and we educate not just physicians deciphering the double helix, but the population to accept that they belong to sort of pools of risk, a bit like insurers do, we're not going to be able to use it, because persons will only be persons for personalized medicine inside these subpopulations. So this is where the whole notion then of targeting things to individuals at risk comes into place, and having to educate GPs, physicians, not just geneticists, and also these companies, if they keep alive and they're allowed to run their business, to make sure they have the proper expertise to target treatments, information, and drugs. Because genetics is largely information. It's not interventions. And hopefully then, if we accept this, we won't end up with orphan drugs. What if you belong to a subgroup that is so small that it's not worth it in a universal healthcare system to make a drug tailored to your condition? So that is something to keep in mind as well. So this brings me to where ethicists are usually come out of the closet and say, well, till everything is shown to be safe, maybe we should wait. It's called the precautionary principle. We should be very careful, and risks can be perceived, and those perceived risks become real in the minds of politicians and in policymakers, and we end up with laws that in the long run are genetic-specific laws and end up stigmatizing people, thinking that having a genetic condition makes them different, whereas it should be a normal part. So I'm a bit, less idealistic about ethics and ethics committees than I was 5 years ago. I went through 18 ethics committees for Cartergy, and 18 different opinions on every word of every consent form, for one consent form for a whole population. So you end up with a lot of fear, some of it legitimate, and I think reflecting fear that citizens have, and that it's a big public investment. But at the same time, if the citizens who participate understand what they're doing, then it seems to me rather paternalistic to tell them that they can't really understand. That, in other words, that they think that citizens in society are not sufficiently able to understand what they do before they participate. So that brings me to my conclusion. If you ask anyone on the street what their main worries are, they'll say privacy. And yet, anyone who has, and I stay far away from it, but I've got children, Facebook and Twitter and friends, in quote, new kinds of friends. Social networking, as we know, is now people exposing themselves, if you like, at their free choice again, in the public domain, and at the same time wanting everything protected. And you can't, in a universal healthcare system, have your card, get in, get treated, and so on, and pay into it without giving up some of your privacy. And at the same time, in a society where the younger generation is very much at ease with this self-exposure, perhaps that will change. The big worry, however, is that every time you find something very good, very specific, very real, and have a compound, we're still years away from being able to justify the outrageous cost. So this is where pharma comes back in again. And the question is, in 2010, can we do like we did in 1990 with the SNP consortium? Can we get pharma, Pfizer, Glaxo, Merck, etc., to come back in and say, things aren't going so good. We haven't had any breakthrough drugs, no aspirin, and even the big ones like we had, like Vioxx, were withdrawn, and Vandia has just been withdrawn. Maybe we should get back in to catalyzing this new science, this new knowledge coming from the population biobanks, which is there for everyone to use, and change the nature of clinical trials by opening their own biobanks. Every time you participate in a clinical trial, leftover bloods and so on are usually kept by the company for audit purposes and so on. But they're kept. They have huge biobanks internally in their own companies. Why not use these biobanks, make them available, just like the citizens in Cartagena and the other projects around the UK Biobank have done, as controls at least for clinical trial, health and reduce the cost of clinical trials and speed up the clinical trials that take 10 years from a discovery to market and about $13 billion. So are we ready? And I conclude with that. Here's now a fellow sort of cynic. The genetic revolution has arrived, but it's not ready to take its place next to the take-home pregnancy test in the drugstore. Unless you have a family history of a disease, you're not really yet a good candidate for general genetic testing. So while we build this population biobanks, it's really not yet sufficient for them. There will be in a few years, but to already help us with the disease-specific questions. So this will change in the future. We resist the lure of genetic testing advertising and its promises about ancestry, your love life, your future. Your future will be far more secure if you spend your time at the gym instead of spitting into a vial. Thank you. So we have about a half an hour of questions. I can't remember too much about Gattaca, but there must be others. Yes? If you can't hear it, he's talking about beta thalassemia, which is a blood disease disorder, particularly in southern European countries, right? Yeah? And your question? How were they treated, though? Was it a gene therapy, you mean? What does it do? Sorry? They use a viral vector? Okay, and they modify the gene and reinsert it? You think that might be there were geneticists in this room, weren't there? Yes? Oh, wait, we'll just finish on this one because I'm trying to get the facts here yet. And so what's your question? Oh, yes, like the bubble children, the autoimmune who they did gene therapy. And actually, it works for a number of years and then they have to redo it again. Well, 1970 was a time when everyone, long before the Human Genome Project, thought that gene therapy would be the next big breakthrough. And other than the bubble children, does anyone know what he's talking about? These are the children that have absolutely no immunity and from birth have to be completely, no autoimmune system, they have to be kept completely protected. And there have been some successful, some not so successful gene therapy done on these children with their genes that have been modified and then reinserted so they could come out of their bubble and, let's say, go to kindergarten and so on. I'm not totally up to date, but I think that they have to go back from time to time. Now, your story is about a beta thalassemia, which is much more common. There's a lot of diseases in that area that is particularly... In southern Europe, people being at risk for thalassemia, but different forms of thalassemia. And there's countries where thalassemia screening is a population screening that's done by the state. Now, I haven't heard about this therapy, so I'm wondering, because normally when something like that comes through, considering the number of individuals around the world who suffer from blood disorders, I think you would have heard a lot more about it. So if you want to send it to me, I'll have it checked out, so to speak. But gene therapy to date has not been successful. And in fact, 10 years ago, when that individual in the University of Pennsylvania died, that young man of 18 years old who was in a gene therapy trial, a lot of the gene therapy trials were shut down in the United States. Yes?
By insurance companies or employers to ask about
Yes, it is. That's the number one issue, as a matter of fact. And thought that this was going to go away was very much discussed in the 1990s, that if you're applying for insurance, insurance is not like buying a car or whatever. It's under law, you are obliged, it's called a contract of utmost good faith. So you're obliged to be totally, totally honest. Because if you hide something, then they don't know where to put your risk factor. And the insurance companies say that if they don't get honest information, and everyone is hiding something or lying about something or not telling them something, then their whole, what's called adverse selection, their whole rating system is going to be wrong and won't be fair to your fellow citizens who are saying the right thing, and you're in the same class as them and you're paying the same premium, but you should be paying $90 more or whatever. Well, I thought it would go away. There have been a lot of laws, particularly in Europe, because don't forget here in Canada we have health insurance, but Europe they have health insurance too. A lot of people say that having access to a minimum amount of life insurance or disability insurance that isn't covered by our universal system is a socioeconomic right. Citizens can't function today without having... and sometimes you even need life insurance to buy a car or a house. They ask you, do you have insurance? So, yes, you have to be totally honest. And yes, the issue is coming back. The United States just passed a law last year saying against genetic discrimination in health insurance. But in Europe, they're going to probably adopt a European law that against genetic discrimination in the area of life insurance and disability insurance. They consider it that every citizen needs it. Not saying that you don't have to pay for it, but that they want to not have it based on genetic risk itself. It's same thing. Yeah. Well, for employers, there's two routes right now. One, for applications, the same, if you lie, you can get fired, just like if you lie in insurance, they can annul your policy. But once you're employed, your employer can only screen you because of where you work, like to see if the air is clean. So once you have an insurance policy, the same thing holds. Once you have it, you have it. They can't annul it unless you've lied. So it's the same for employers and insurers. As a precondition, the response usually today is no. But once you're employed or once you have your insurance, to then start asking these questions, that's called genetic discrimination. And most of it comes from a perception of having something, not that you really have it. Yes, ahead of time, that could well be true, because they say employment is a privilege, not a right. They'll say insurance is a privilege, not a right. Yes?
The FDA is a huge bureaucracy, and it's costing drug companies millions upon billions of dollars to develop one valid treatment because of this incredibly top-heavy bureaucracy, which is putting impediments at every step of the way. Now, I'm wondering, wouldn't it be better if we privatized drug and genetic testing to see if these drugs are safe or if these genetic tests are valid and so on? Wouldn't it be better to have companies, private companies, doing this work?
In a competitive marketplace, you mean?
Having something like Consumer Reports or, you know, these companies being essentially providing the information, but people should be free to decide to try some experimental treatment or some genetic testing if they want, because I don't think that the government's role is to protect us from everything. I think it's our duty to inform ourselves and to act accordingly, and act also according to our best needs and our knowledge. So I don't know how you feel about the FDA, but I have
I'll take a parallel. Yesterday, as you know, all the Fisher-Price toys from I don't know what, how many millions, and all the daycares were going crazy looking, and all grandmothers and mothers looking, checking high chairs for protruding something or other. And someone actually got on the television and said, haven't we got to be so risk-averse, so zero tolerance, that in order to avoid a hypothetical risk in the future, governments, exactly like you were saying, are slowing down or costing incredible dollars to the community by overprotecting their citizens. I've heard that argument. I'd rather that the testing quality, safety assurance, and the monitoring and oversight thereof was in government hands. However, individuals are currently free to go where they want if they can afford it for the treatments. Probably not so much in Canada, though, but elsewhere. Yeah, in the States, in Europe, India, China, and so on. The problem then is when these individuals come back, if there are sequelae or problems with their health stemming from the treatments, experimental, in quotes, elsewhere, then they end up back in our system with often quite serious. But people will go. If there's clinical trials and they're ill and there's no answer, no drug, no test, no anything, or it's not recognized by Health Canada, they will go to where, particularly parents, okay? I work on children in the law, and parents, being a parent, I think probably any parent would probably almost do anything to save their child. So it's, then you get what's called tourism, like stem cell tourism and the clinics in India for the transplants and so on. There was another hand up, but I can't remember. Yes. Yes. let's just take the Assisted Procreation Act of Canada that came into force in 2004. It actually has, this is very controversial. First of all, in Quebec today, all children, regardless of the origins of their birth, adopted, embryo donation, sperm or egg donation, or custom adoption in the Indian communities in the north and so on, all children are equal. And to break a file, a confidential file, which is there because Quebec recognizes before bloodlines, which it used to up to 1994, recognizes what we call the sociological filiation. It says that children should be treated as a child of the person who has brought them up. It used to be the paternal and all the other stuff. It's now a social, to have family continuity, security, and so on, and have the children all be the same. You used to have illegitimate children, all that kind of stuff. And so the only way you can break either adoption records or the sealed records concerning sperm, egg, or embryo donation are if there's a serious medical condition in the child. If the child has something that they can't figure out where it came from, then you can go to the court, not a social worker. You have to go to the court to get a court order, and they will try to do it as much as possible without the child knowing if the child doesn't know. Now, adoption, as you know, has gone through a whole more open... but remember, adoption is usually a child that was conceived in conditions where there were two people who must have had some encounter somewhere, which is quite different from going to a sperm bank or so on. And as you know, as of August the 5th, Quebec is the first province in Canada to offer three in vitro tries to infertile couples because... there was such an industry of ovarian stimulation, dangerous for women, creating multiple embryos because they already had mortgaged their house twice to go through IVF, and so they said, just put them all in, give us five, we want five children, which of course creates usually triplets and there's health problems. So we are still in the anonymity field in Quebec, but there is a law that in the Federal Assisted Procreation Act, I'm sorry to be so long-winded, but it's legal stuff, that says that there can two classes of donors in Canada today. If you go as a donor, you can say, yes, somebody can come find me when they're 18. You presume that the parents will tell the child. They may or they may not. And then you can also say, no, I'm a donor. I want to help. Infertility is, you know, serious business for a lot of couples. It's very heartbreaking. It's terrible. But I want to have peace, and, you know, who knows, I might get married one day and have my own children. Remember, if you're an anonymous donor, you can't go back looking for your child either. Because this has happened. The reverse, people keep presuming it's children looking. It often happens the other way. That law is being contested by Quebec for that part of it, the privacy part of it, not the criminal surrogacy is criminal, cloning is criminal. That Quebec is in agreement with the federal government. But they're contesting this notion that you are your bloodline, and that a 30-second or 3-minute or however long it takes sperm donor is actually confused with being a real father, because that is not the way that family law has been developed in this province. So I don't know, did I answer your question? Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yes? Yes, it is.
To me, it's not going to be sorted out in our lifetime. You're not going to be able to send your spit off and get a good answer for another 2,000 years.
Yeah.
It's just not possible.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's not a good idea, it's just that it's not possible.
Yeah. I mean, and that's kind of the beautiful part of it as well, that the more you learn, the less you know, because even between the disease areas now, they're discovering links. So if you sign a consent form for breast cancer, and then 10 years later they discover there's a link to ovarian cancer, and then suddenly the consent says only breast cancer, and you think, oh my God, I have to go back and find these 20,000 women I've collected over 10 years to reconsent them, because the ethics committee said, they said breast, they didn't say ovarian, and then 5 years later pancreatic comes up. So that's why not only is the field complex, these very narrow consents that were disease specific are now all being revisited, including all the samples that are in pathology in hospitals. What do we do with those? What do we do with the extra bloods when you're tested, when you come in to see if you're a bleeder, as they call it, or not? Or what do you do with leftover urines? Are they all have to be consented? Yes, you may use them for research or not, and so on. So as the science gets more complex, you don't want your consent forms to look like a notarized deed, you know. And but if you make them too simple, too open, then people say, well, that's not really informed, because you're just saying, do what you want, you know. So but you're right. And in particular, the genome-wide association studies have shown, that's the latest after the, that we're not going to get anywhere on the common diseases, that the population biobanks probably will be used to look for, because they're the only ones who have the numbers, for the rare variants that contribute to the common diseases. So that's not even in the consent form, but that, I think, is what the science is going to end up doing. And you would know, because you obviously know more about the science than I do. Yes? The question had to be why we're not using knowledge we already have in a more efficient, probably cost efficient as well, and more human, and instead of submitting everyone to H1N1 vaccine, or not checking if people are fast or slow metabolizers before we give them drugs. I don't think my physician knows if I'm a fast or slow metabolizer. And I know that's one of the first areas that when you're explaining the role of pharmacogenomics, you say, just like metabolism, everybody goes, oh yeah, just like metabolism has an effect on drugs. It's common sense is what you're saying. But we haven't quite done the tests, and we should be using those. And for research, we should be doing tests, pharmacogenomic tests, to exclude people who would be at risk. So in other words, do genetic tests to see if anyone would be one of these persons who in phase one trials would have a, which are pretty toxic, that they already are at genetic risk and they shouldn't even be in them. Yeah, I think it's the zero tolerance and it's the risk aversive, and particularly the level of governments, I think you're going to have, and now companies too, because of the liability and the Vioxx and their shares and so on. And yeah, it's very, very cautious. Yeah. Yes.
Prediction if there is, as you said, it's correct today,
Yeah, people already have all those warning bracelets that they wear or cards in their wallets which people forget to take out. And your question is about why they're never used or donor cards? And allergies, yep. Yeah, they're talking about what they call the sort of smart cards for when you enter hospitals. So it's not just your hospital admission card, but it also would have basic information. Like, for instance, I only have one kidney, for instance. If they start looking, they're going to really wonder, what you know, or that you're allergic to codeine or morphine or whatever, or that someone is an epileptic. So as soon as you come in, that the government has been experimenting with for I don't know how long. It has to do with privacy because they want people to be able to update the information on their smart cards, which means making them responsible for the updating. And the physicians, and perhaps rightly so, are a bit worried about people mucking around with what they think they're at risk for or what they think that they what they need. So there's a sort of a power thing there. I know for billing purposes it's perfect, but when you start having people take information out or adding information into their own medical record, and that's your especially in a system that is not privatized but universal, you're taking risks, I think. Did you have a question that you wanted to ask about Cartagene or
just a comment. Mm-hmm.
Except at the end, there was a...
Something that was, outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the questions.
Yeah.
That was a little frustrating. I was in that was fantastic experience. It was very efficient, friendly, professional.
The snack was okay. We had big complaints about the snack.
Okay. I imagine some people might have been hungry.
Yeah. It's a long... It takes time. Okay, it takes time. Now, Cartagene, this is one of these population biobanks, and the questions are all standardized so that our question here in Quebec, and then usually it's not so much the question that has to be standardized, but the variables, as the epidemiologists call it, underneath, like about drinking or smoking, it won't just be do you drink or do you smoke. That is really nothing, because if we ask that question in Japan, they smoke something completely different. The French are on Gauloise, and we're on, I don't know, Marlboro or whatever people smoke. So it's the sort of subcategory of variables where Cartagene is part of an international project, not only the Canadian Partnership for Tomorrow 300,000-person Canadian project, but a project called the Public Population Project in Genomics. And this one is trying to harmonize, not standardize, at least 250 variables around the world, in Asia, Africa, everywhere where they're having these population biobanks, so that at least those variables are compatible, so we can have the size that we need, on statistically speaking, to have significance in certain environmental indicators for gene-environment interactions. So that's why you can't deviate, at all. There is a communication exit questionnaire, but that's more general about the experience. It's not the questions themselves that people are supposed to receive as they leave to fill in. Yeah, absolutely, and you will, no it isn't, and it's considered too expensive. In fact, there is one study in Canada, Canadian Health Measurement Survey, where they go in the homes, but now there's a privacy complaint against the study, when they go in and they measure with these wands or something. But if you're in Cartagene, you'll probably get in about 2 months a questionnaire online probably for environment and nutrition. Because those were the two parts that across the country, in order to get 300,000 people in a project, Cartagene itself is 27 million, the 300,000, I can't even imagine. And that's just a very basic blood, urine, and a 1.5-hour questionnaire into a database that's searchable, organized, and where you can recontact people if they say yes for further stuff, which is very important, like air. And we need a lot more about diet, for sure. Like metabolism questions and all that. Yeah, very, very basic. Yeah, well, I don't know. I'll have to check the protocol on the diet and on nutrition and environment if there's any places for people to add. Or yeah, I don't know. But that's the interesting part. Yes, and last question. Okay. I'll bring up why I have an interest in public health. In about 1994, when the new civil code came in, we used to have a project in Quebec where we would take, you know, newborn screening, the heel prick test on babies that's done to see if they have PKU or hypothyroidism and so on. These are immediately treatable. You've got to get these kids fast. You can't wait for a year later or whatever. And we used to batch, I used to do work with the geneticists, by region, so we wouldn't know what hospital they came from, anonymously, with just taking another little punch out of that card, that blood spot card, the Guthrie card, and send them by 20,000 to the public health laboratory to test for HIV. We didn't want to know where people were. We didn't want to know anything. We wanted to know, was it going up or was it going down? And 1994, the new civil code came in saying anything removed during medical care, and obviously the heel prick test is medical care for the newborn, you had to have a written consent with a form and a this and a that. So it stopped. So we didn't know, we still don't know, is HIV going up or is it going down? Because you need a population. You need a whole population. You don't want people who say that they're coming in, because that's just, you're self-selecting, and then you end up with bias. So these population maps, like Cartagena, where people are picked, presumably healthy, in the population between age 40 and 69, but ideally should do it from birth, have the statistically randomized population who serve as a map against which public health officials then can use these specimens and so on without being able to find the person to see where individuals may be at higher risk for H1N1 by gender, by region, by age or whatever, and not spend millions on vaccinating everyone because you don't know, have sufficient information to know really who is a resistor.
At this point,
we didn't have that information yet. For sure. I mean, I think hindsight, to tell the WHO, which got hit, you know, really hard with the SARS, WHO got hit with the Creutzfeldt-Jakob and the blood system. I mean, we always find someone to blame, and then when no one really gets sick, we say, well, then why did we do it? It's exactly like you're saying. It's a kind of, it's just, I'm saying in the future, we won't be able to sustain our universal healthcare system. We will never be able to maybe afford such a massive vaccination again. And that's where knowledge can help us be more targeted in where we spend our money, and not only for treatment, for prevention and for health promotion. So for me, that is what genetics is about. And that's where the personal joins the population. That's where the two meet, is when that decision-making has to come. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you all for your questions. As we always have, great questions and great debate stimulated, obviously on a very complex topic. So, a little token of appreciation on behalf of the Alumni Association. So thank you very much. And I'd like to remind everyone the next class, if you register for one, starts in about 10 minutes. And the reception is at 5:30 in the arts lobby where you came in. And as with all McGill activities, drinks will be served during the lecture. So thank you again.
Really? UK Biobank is at 8%. assistance, yeah, for general.
I think I mentioned before, though, haven't I?
No.
Well, let me know how that goes, because for teaching purposes, it would be great in class to get in there and see, you know, just at least the point of entry of the information. Especially when all the you know, the techie people and the privacy people will get at it. Is it like a USB? See, that's it. I've got to retire so I can have fun. I'm just really not that guy up there. Why? I'm just considering my crippled state. Sorry, did you have a question?
I just have a very open question. Mm-hmm. You had a very, very sick child that had doubled his work. His weight, and it's on a broad spectrum. When do you know, like, 10% chance of having the same thing? Where is the person who brings it?
Well, you're asking someone who doesn't have the education to answer that. You probably should go see, it was a pediatric case, is that true?
Pediatric, yeah.
You should go see his boss. You should go see David Rosenblatt, his... yeah, David knows everything, right?
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious. Maybe
it's
just like
a matter of curiosity.
Well, he would know. He's the expert in Quebec on that. And he's also my chair. And,
I was horrified. 2%. I never took such a high risk.
Well, David was a lot in human genetics. Black with two T's. If you remember, write it down, and then he's still, before he retires or leaves or does anything drastic, you should make an appointment to see him. He's very open.
It starts to repeat itself.
Yeah.
You said his name is
David Rosenblatt.
Rosenblatt.
Yeah, David Rosenblatt.